When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of a bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. I'm really excited about this one, and I've dragged Nina along with me because she's excited too. Nina, how are you, and what are we doing today?
Oh, very good. Thank you very much. So today we're going to take a look at the ever intriguing, fascinating, and challenging story of the Franklin Expedition. And we're doing that today because we're talking to Ernest Coleman, who is a former naval man, polar adventurer, and a historian who's written 22 books. Now I'm absolutely jealous, including Khaki Jack, the Royal Navy Division in the First World War, the intriguingly titled The Pig War. But today he's here to talk to us about his newest book, No Earthly Pole, The Search for the Truth About the Franklin Expedition, 1845. Welcome, sir.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me.
We're delighted to have you today. So Chris and I had a bit of a wrestling match on this one, and we've agreed that with all the questions that we have, that we're going to take turns asking you. While I'm a 19th century historian, I'm not an expert on polar history, but it has been something I've been fascinated with for quite a while. And of course, the thing and the question which occupied so much of the latter part of the 19th century, well into the 20th, and here we are in the 21st, is the story of the Franklin Expedition and what actually happened. So what got you interested in the expedition in the first place?
Well, one of my last jobs in the Navy was as a recruiting officer for Lincolnshire. So while I was there, and I actually live in Lincolnshire now, whilst I was there, I thought, it's too much RAF. You know, Royal Air Force all over the place. And yet we've got to find naval history and great names like Flinders, Bass, Banks, and of course, Franklin, the leading four, if you like, or John Smith, who brought Pocahontas over, comes from there. And so I wrote a book, and it's my very first book, called The History of the Navy in Lincolnshire.
Right.
And the more I looked into Franklin, the more I kept thinking, there's something odd here. You know, he just disappeared. And up until the Scott expedition, of course, to the Antarctic, people always considered the Franklin expedition as the one big mystery and naval disaster, if you like.
Right.
So I decided to look further and further into it, and then I managed to persuade the Admiralty to let me go up there and have a look.
Had you had any Arctic experience prior to this? I know you were a naval man for more than 30 years, and so you know you've been on all manner of different expeditions, different craft, submarine, etc., etc. Had you been to the Arctic before you decided this was a topic that you wanted to investigate?
This is a sort of cheapskate answer. This is before, when I was 16, I was on the Ark Royal aircraft carrier,
right?
And we did Arctic trials or ice trials, or whatever you choose to call them, up into the Davis Straits,
okay.
And I thought it was spectacular because you used to have a thing called Arctic sea smoke. Now, that means there's a mist all over all the water as far as you can see. And so you appear to be sailing through a cloud.
Oh, gosh.
And because I was slightly naughty on one occasion, I was sentenced to 2 hours extra work. And I was sent up to chip the ice off one of the radar domes.
Yes.
It was a wonderful sensation. But that is the only experience I'd had before.
Oh, gosh.
The main purpose of the expedition was to find the Northwest Passage. But why is it so important? And why is Britain and the Royal Navy trying to secure it?
I'm not so sure about the word secure. When Franklin set off, it was pointed out this was an achievement for humanity, if they could do it. Because to get to, if you went westwards and you wanted to reach the Pacific and further on, it's a long way down, right the way down past Cape of Good Hope, the tip of the southern tip of South America. Whereas if we could go from the north and across the top of Canada and that, it would make a terrific trading route. Something, interestingly enough, that still applies today. It would make a great trading route. And, of course, it would be open to everybody. That was the point. If the Royal Navy discovered it, then great. But we weren't going to put customs barriers on it or anything.
Excellent. Your expedition north, and I'm so glad you told us of the, you know, sort of your first encounter and the particular punishment, which meant you were spending a great deal of time outside chipping ice. Yeah. From the expeditions, because this project was multiple expeditions. It wasn't just one and done. What did you find the region was like in terms of just climate, in terms of ability to travel and so on and so forth?
Well, prior to that, I'd never been into the Arctic in the dead of winter. I actually have since. And the Arctic in winter is beautiful. There's no question of that. But very unfriendly. You need to go in the summer if you're going to do any research, because you need the snow to get clear off the land. Most of the water is going to stay frozen, but you can use the land as a means, and the ice if you have to. But if you're looking for something, you need it cleared, and that's what it was. And it very quickly came to me that the Arctic in summer can be very unpleasant. You've got your polar bears that are a threat when you're home, because they think you're an upright seal, and they, you know, if you're not careful, you don't want to end your day looking through the rear end of a polar bear.
Pretty much, yes.
And it can be unfriendly, just the same. But then again, that's just one of life's challenges.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, nowadays, the sort of equipment that we might have access to is, you know, incredibly different in terms of durability, in terms of design. In terms of your travels, obviously, in order to stay safe, you had to use 20th century technology. But were you able to sort of get a grasp, do you think, of what it would have been like for Franklin and his men in the 1845 to try to travel in that area without access to the kinds of, you know, things that we have?
Yeah, pretty much the same, because all I had was a tent, and that was it. In bad conditions, it was pretty awful, particularly wind, because wind tended to flatten the tent. You've got that. And if you're really unfortunate, as I was on a few occasions, you can get water dripping through the holes onto your sleeping bag, which is quite annoying, actually. but I set up, I shall stick with my solo expedition. That was the most interesting one. The reason it's more advantage to be on your own is that even if there's two of you, the chap who's didn't share in the tent with you might have had a bad night's sleep, and then you're ready to go. And this happened on a few occasions.
Yeah,
you've got to wait for him to wake up and want to go.
Right. So,
of course, don't forget it's 24 hours daylight.
Yes.
So I decided to set off from the camp I had and walk as far north as possible onto King William Island, which is one of the central island that's involved in all this. And I wanted to see where Franklin's ships had got stuck. So I did quite a lot of walking. I was armed because you really can't go up there without some means of defence if the polar bears decide.
Of course.
And I saw polar bears, and I'm probably the wrong shape or something.
thankfully.
And they didn't, only on one occasion did they come for us. And luckily, we were just about to board a helicopter. But on this, I'll go back to the solo one. It was about 40 miles, and I had to do it in 2 days. And I thought, well, this is just the way they would have done it. They'd on their feet, get going. It's not a very smooth passage. The surface of the ground is fractured rocks. And that's why occasionally you take to the ice, because the ice can be. But it was just an interesting exercise. And I found out that something I didn't know is that when it gets very cold, propane doesn't work.
Oh, God.
I couldn't eat anything. There was nothing to put. But then again, God built me like this, and I'm all right.
You were all right.
Yeah,
there's an unexpected development for you.
Yeah.
Did you have any problems with navigation? Because I know that Franklin's crew suffered from this. A ship's compasses couldn't pick up north because it's constantly shifting. Did you have any problems with that?
No, because compasses weren't a great deal. I always used to think my compass pointed to the rifle. It's the first bit of metal that it could, you know, point at.
Right.
No, the navigation wasn't really difficult because you're walking up. I always kept the coast about a mile from where I was walking. And if you can keep the coast in sight, then it's not a problem.
Right.
Yes. Some of the areas are, but my hated favourite place was a place called Wall Bay. And in summer, it's notorious that there seems to be a fog hangs over that always. Right. So again, I got closer to the shore, so for that. But it was very strange. It was fog like I'd never known before. It was like being in your own sort of little cave that you're moving forward, and your visibility was a matter of just a few yards.
Gosh.
So I plodded on through that, quite concerned that a polar bear would be perfect to spring out at you.
Absolutely.
Again, they obviously didn't fancy me, so but nothing happened. And coming out the other side. Generally, anyone capable of a decent walk could manage it. There's nothing particularly special about that.
Right.
So going back to the expedition, what kind of man was Sir John Franklin? And was he a good choice to hang on, start that again. See, it's always me. So what kind of man was Sir John Franklin? And was he a good choice to lead this expedition?
I think he was a perfect choice. He was always extremely popular with his men in his leadership. He had a massive experience. Even when, as a midshipman, he took part in Arctic expeditions. When he was made captain, he led 2 overland expeditions, very, very important ones. And he didn't believe in, they used to call it Franklin's paradise when he had a ship, he was the captain of a ship, and he didn't believe in the kind of punishment we all know by tradition was meted out to sailors. They didn't ship ice off for a couple of hours. They got a good taking the cat's punishment.
Right.
And he didn't believe in that. Also, in his early life, he had a lot of interesting things. He fought alongside Nelson twice at the Battle of Copenhagen and, of course, the Battle of Trafalgar. Now, he was a very popular man in naval terms.
Mm. So those sorts of things, that you're going to take a crew of men into what is essentially the unknown and have them overwinter, I would imagine, and you know, you can speak to this as a Navy man yourself, that those leadership qualities, the ability to inspire, you know, at this point, your men, I would imagine that that would be an important factor in the success of anything that you were doing.
Yeah, I entirely agree. You couldn't have a Captain Bligh up there. That wouldn't work. Franklin was a good leader. He'd never failed. He wasn't very good at diplomacy. One time he was the Lieutenant Governor of Tasmania.
Right, right. I remember.
And he fell out time and again with the politicians, and the politicians eventually had him removed because he didn't like the way they were treating the locals, and his wife built a museum. You know, they did a lot of very, very good work for the benefit of people. And the politicians were saying more or less, you're not in this business for that. You know, that's not what you're here for.
Right.
But I think he was probably very happy to have that opportunity to lead the expedition.
He'd been to the Arctic previously as well, hadn't he?
Well, yes, he had two massive overland expeditions. There's the Mackenzie River, and the other one, name escapes me for the moment, but the Copper Mine River.
Yeah.
And they were in themselves successful. He had a bit of rotten luck because he had some poor condition. He was supposed to meet another ship on the west side, west corner, if you like, of North America, mainland, and he missed it by 150 miles.
Oh, gosh.
Now, for that, he had to walk
a little bit.
Hundreds and hundreds of miles back. But he got through, but it was very, very difficult for him, and that showed terrific leadership.
One of the aspects that has been considered in recent studies of Franklin's expedition is the way that they were equipped and provisioned. And so how do you understand that particular aspect and how it might have affected or not affected the outcome in terms of equipment, food?
The ships, first of all, they were experienced ships, if you like. They'd been around for a while, and they'd been to the Antarctic, and they were known to be good ice vessels, if you like. But where the state of the art came in was when they put a steam engine on board.
Right.
And the engine, I think they took the engine from the Greenwich Light Railway.
Yeah.
And, of course, one of the axle shafts would have been attached to a propeller outside. And they really thought about this because they thought, what if you get trapped in the ice? So in the stern, they had what they called a well. And that's where, if you were going into ice, you could lift the propeller out.
Of course.
Now, coal was the only fuel they could use. They used it as ballast for a start. That was a good common sense thing, because you could always replace with rock and things be going. It didn't work all that well. It was a new technology to have ships with engines engines in. It was there, and it really wasn't, it didn't have the punch to get you through ice or anything like that. But if I can go to food, food is an astonishing story. Half of the supply of canned food that was supplied to Franklin and the two ships, Terra and Erebus, the other half was left in Portsmouth Dockyard because they were finding another ship, you know, supplying other ships with it.
Right.
And guess what they found? When Franklin had gone, he'd lost all communication with him. The stench from the food in Portsmouth Dockyard was leading to complaints from people who lived around there.
Oh, that's right.
Absolutely rotting away.
Yeah.
Now, you've got to say, well, Franklin's got the same thing.
Right.
And that's why I think it was about 12,000 cans were put on board the two ships.
Right.
And yet only 600 have been accounted for.
Gosh.
Now, because metal, we come to this later, metal is so rare in the Arctic, there's just a little bit of copper, but that's it. They decided they would have only thrown it overboard. But the thing that they had there was lead in the cans. There were seals with lead. Lead was useful for musket balls and a variety of such matters. So that's why on Beachy Island, which was where the first evidence was found,
right,
the major thing there was a forge. And that's what they did. They got empty cans of the food and then melted the lead from the tins. And they're still there today, examples of those tins. But to be able to trace no more than 600 out of thousands means that they were just dumped, got rid of them as quick as you can.
Right.
They wouldn't have had to have gone short of food. One of the favourite, killing birds, seabirds and things like that, then they were hung in the rigging to dry out, and they were there. And of course, once they got further south, having gone into Lancaster Sound and then worked their way through the Arctic, there's a lot of caribou, and there are musk oxen, and even polar bears, although polar bears you had to be careful of because the livers of polar bears are poisoned.
Right, exactly.
So food could survive, it was enough to survive, and it must have been at their time because frankly making the decision to carry on.
Right, right. Still, that requires a great deal of extra effort if you're going to hunt and, you know, feed that many men on two ships, which I assume, you know, must have provided quite the challenge for them in terms of survival.
The officers those days were all trained in hunting, whether for horseback or whatever.
Sure.
And the animals, as I experienced, they don't quite know humans are friendly or not. They'll come up to you and stare at you. And and the musk ox, I once saw a wonderful sight where they saw me and retreated into a large circle with all the heads pointing out.
Right, right.
And then I watched as on another expedition when a friend of mine, he advanced to the musk ox, whereupon the musk ox charged, he turned sensibly and ran off, and immediately the musk ox stopped. Got to waste energy chasing something you can't eat.
Exactly. Interesting.
Circling back to the lead, some of the first artifacts that were discovered were, of course, the graves of Torrington Brain and the local boy to me, Hartnell. Their autopsies revealed that they had high levels of lead in their systems, which some people have argued that lead poisoning could have been a major factor to the expedition. But it's also quite contentious, isn't it?
It's total nonsense. Even to me, as a non-specialist in that sort of thing, I knew that they lived on water supplied through lead pipes. they dined off pewter plates, which, you know, contains lead. Most of them came from towns and cities where they'd grown up with lead. It gets murkier too, because one of the expedition that claimed all this, he said to me that what they did with the lead, I didn't know this, but the amount of lead in a human hair varies along its length. Hmm. And so what they'd done was cut all the high bits out, and they're the one that was tested. And that led to the... Actually, they died of pneumonia or tuberculosis. That's what they died of. It got even better for me, at least, was when a Canadian university went to Nelson's Dockyard in Antigua and dug into a naval cemetery there from the same period. And guess what?
Everyone's got their lead.
Exactly the same level of lead in the bodies.
Right. So that gives us another perspective in terms of how we might think about the physical outcomes and the health outcomes for the sailors. Is if this is, you know, certainly one thought about how they might have died, but, you know, causes us to step back and start considering other things that might have happened. But we do know that something must have gone terribly wrong. Because, you know, of course, they didn't survive, and multiple expeditions, including your own, to try to understand what happened. What do you think went wrong with the Terror and the Erebus? What in terms of your own work and your travels there, how might you suggest or what do you suggest to your, I mean, I got a chance to read a book, but I'm not going to give it away. But What would you suggest to potential readers of the book that they consider the actual things that might have happened to the sailors?
Yeah, if we're talking about the position suddenly where the expedition went wrong, was
right.
Very, very simple and totally unexpected.
Mm.
When they came down Peel Sound.
Mm-hmm.
And they were. It was. They must have been really very cheerful because they were all heading in the right direction. But
yeah.
Then suddenly they hit ice. No big deal. That's what you know, expeditions are about.
Yeah.
They knew that the best thing to do. Well, you've got a choice. You could have retreated without, you know, having got that far. They
right.
wouldn't have wanted to do that. You got in the ice. The ice builds around you, and you're locked in the ice for the winter. That was fine. Everything went fine. And they had their, what we used to call in my time in the Navy, sort of sods operas and entertainment, things like that. To get them through,
right.
There would have been hunting ashore, because you could walk ashore from ships, no question of that. They put up markers that could indicate the direction of drift. And
sure.
So I think it was fine. Then, to their surprise, when summer came, it remained frozen instead of coming through. Again, they thought, well, okay, Franklin said, you know, that, all right, we'll stick it out for another year until and give it a go next year. Now this is 2 years in total of being stuck in that ice.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
They were spent a lot of time ashore. We know there are evidence of camps ashore that this would almost certainly be hunting expeditions. But one thing that they couldn't cater for, I don't believe, and evidence all suggests this, is that that you needed some to fight scurvy with.
Right.
There was lots of lot of greenery or anything, no trees, nothing at all.
Right.
And scurvy would have been a problem. Then June, the following year, after they got stuck in the second year, Franklin died. And, that's not about, this is something they could have handled. They knew that this was possible. He was considered an old man at the time. Then he was about 59, coming 60. Crozier took over then. He was an experienced seaman and Arctic, had Arctic experience. But then when they stayed into 1848, so this is the third year they're in there now,
right,
it didn't break up again.
Right.
And this was suddenly the situation changed dramatically. Also, what are the state of the ships? Because they've managed to resist ice pressing on them and all the rest. They probably said, well, look, we're not going to last another year here. Scurvy, I think, would have broken out. And it's a desperate, threatening disease.
Yes.
And so they decided that they'd make a go for it. 105 men landed on that shore. Mm-hmm. We know now, because they've found the ships, and we know that they secured, what we call secured the ships for sea. Mm-hmm. Men battened down the hatches, did everything so it'll keep afloat. If it's not crushed, it will stay afloat. They're made of wood, after all. They then, 105 men came ashore and had to tow, not over the ice. People think they did the ice. They went over land. Right. I actually found an unknown camp by Crozier. And it's very, very interesting that there I found the shape of a boat in rocks. And that is clearly where that they surrounded with the rocks, probably took the insides out to do repairs and things like that, but it was propped up with these rocks. And then they just pull it off afterwards. If you've got men with scurvy, it's a terrible condition. They can hardly eat. Jaws swell, the lips swell, the tongue swells. And energy, trying to pull anything or heave on it, debilitating is the way, and yet they had to do it.
How much do you have a sense of how much the loaded boats, which I assume they're trying to pull across, and I know there you spend some time in one of the chapters describing what the surface is like with slabs, heaving and crossed and so on. Mm-hmm. So just to give our listeners a sense, what are we talking about in terms of what something like that might have weighed, distributed among men who are clearly debilitated, perhaps, as you're saying, they're not able to eat frequently, they're ill. The physical challenge must have been tremendous.
It absolutely would. We talked about leadership.
Right.
And leadership and teamwork. Nobody wants to let down anybody else, and they're all going to give it a try. The boats themselves, there would all have been 27-foot whalers. Large wooden boats.
Right.
Heavily built, simply on the principle that they're going to be operating in ice.
Of course. Yeah.
So they would have been very heavy. We're not quite sure how many they drag with them.
Right.
It's probably no more, four would have been maximum. Absolutely.
Yes.
And they would have done it in relays, sort of the amount they needed to get it moving.
Right.
They would be taken over by a similar amount. It's normal organisation that would have aided them there. And they did a tremendous job. They got all the way down to the southwest corner of Prince of Wales Island. We do know that Franklin sent Lieutenant Gore and Lieutenant DeVoe on an expedition when the ships were still locked in the ice to look at the route.
Right.
And they would have said, you can't go over the ice. The ice is the obvious choice because it would slide.
It could slide, yeah, exactly.
But you've only got to look at the ice in Victoria Sound or the Victoria, and it's masses, huge on the road, on even ice, the size of houses, you know, great blocks. You just couldn't do it.
Right.
So the land is relatively flat.
Mm-hmm.
And so off they went. And that brings us to that bit, was Erebus Bay. Erebus Bay, I think what happened, no one's really put this before, we know that there were remains, in fact I found some, further to the south.
Mm-hmm.
So they split one way or another, their division. I'm convinced that the division was not something caused by conflict or anything else. I think it really was that some of the men just couldn't do the job. They couldn't pull the boats anymore. And I like to think what I would have done, and I believe this is what Crozier did, was to treat it like a First World War casualty clearing station.
Triage.
He said to all the ones who couldn't make it, all right, men, look, here's the thing, what we're going to do. We're going to leave you a boat or two boats and, you know, we'll leave you food, which we know they did, which still existed. We're going to leave, and you will stay here until the ice melts. Now, Gore and DeVoe must have found that the bottom bit of the ice was melting during the summers. That's not a big deal. That's the way it works. Even if the top of the straits are thick with ice, the bottom bit turns, because you've got the warm Pacific effect. And so having done that, they would have probably left them with a few arms, and perhaps a couple of volunteers, you know, so we'll look after them, we'll do this, that, and the other, while we go. And so just hang on here, keep yourself alive, the ice will melt, get your boats on the water, and then head off.
They didn't really have much other choice, really, but in hindsight, it's always 20/20, but was Crozier's plan to head south a good idea, considering... Would they have been better off to stay with the boat, with Terra and Erebus?
There were a couple of options. Sir John Ross, in one of his expeditions, left a ship across something called the Boothia Peninsula.
Hmm.
But I believe, and I'm not alone in this, there are rumours that Ross abandoned that ship, the natives actually sort of got on board and stripped it, and there would be nothing left. So that immediately cut your options in about half. You could have tried to retreat, but it was too late. When they first met the ice, they could have retreated, but they wouldn't want to do that. And they couldn't move from there with the ships. I can't think of anything else that was open to them.
So faced with this sort of a challenge, what can you tell us about Crozier as a leader? I mean, you know, we've spoken at length, and you've reminded us of Franklin's wealth of experience and his Arctic experience. What kind of a leader was Crozier meant to be? I mean, he's second in command here. He, of course, is going to, you know, one assumes, step up and was ready to step up into such a leadership position if needs be.
Yeah, I think I've met one of his descendants, actually.
Oh, you did? That's right. I mentioned that in the book, yes.
And he'd got the middle name, Rawdon Crozier.
Right.
Which was, to have got to be a captain in the Navy, you have to have certain skills because you're going to be a danger elsewhere.
Right.
There's decades and centuries even of experience of who's good and who's the one to take off. I can't think of any reason why Crozier, who's a good seaman, we know he could handle ships. If he can handle ships, he has to be able to handle men.
Right.
And I've never come across any complaint about Crozier. And I think he was certainly adequate, even if he might not have been brilliant, but he was good enough. And to persuade his men that we're going to depart leave these ships, get ashore. And he wasn't using methods of threats of disciplinary punishments to do it. It just wouldn't work. They wouldn't have allowed it. And they were acting as teams when they were dragging those boats. The boats wouldn't have moved if they hadn't.
Right.
All this points to the fact that I believe that Crozier was a very good leader.
What kind of relics have been left behind? Because unlike other shipwrecks and things where in more populated areas where bits go missing and people find them all the time, there's not many people traipsing around the Arctic lifting things. And they keep finding odds and sods.
Well, we have found, or the ships have been found, Erebus in Queen Maud Gulf, again, which is to the south of that ice that they had to, so it has clearly drifted right the way through into Queen Maud Gulf. Mm-hmm. And then a rather odd one, the Terror drifted against the tide, if you like. The flow of the water and drifted into what had, how's this for the chances, what previously known as Terror Bay. And Terror Bay, the Terror itself is in a very good condition and it displays all the bits about the ideas about we've got to secure for sea.
Right.
Batten hatches and close all the doors,
right.
Everything to be ready to go.
Interesting.
It's sort of a marvellous thing to find.
Yeah. And you found, in addition to what you mentioned earlier in the podcast, a section of rock which may have supported a boat for repairs.
Yes.
I think you mentioned in your book that you found one or two other relics that you are convinced are related to the Franklin expedition. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
I hope I haven't over-egged it.
There was at least one, though, that I know.
One of the maps showing where the route that Franklin's men took,
mm-hmm.
I think, has been copied and turned the wrong way round. I mentioned this in the book.
Yeah.
Because it matches a particular area on the way south.
Right.
If you turn it round. I went to visit that, and it's very, very strange. I must admit, it made me almost jump out of my skin.
Oh, God.
And I came down, and I found a shape of an arrow made of rocks pointing to this spot. So I went along the beach there, climbed up one of these eskers are sort of inland beaches,
right,
and there were a row of six what just looked like graves.
The
Canadians don't really want, it's a bit political now. They don't want to do too much up there because of their own political problems they've got.
Right.
But they were a shock just to see that. The only thing of any tiniest piece of consequence was walking along a beach within Lady Franklin Bay and coming across a toggle. a wooden hand-carved toggle, which were exactly the type that you use on sledge harnesses. And drove that. So that I brought that back and gave it to the Canadians at Yellowknife, and there it's in their museum and whatever. The only other one particularly, I wasn't very well and in a tent, and I was in a spot for 2 days at least, hoping for changing conditions of the weather as much as anything. And I thought I'd have a walk around. Well, just behind me was a slope, and I went up this slope, and that's where I found cairns, that shape of the boat and everything. Right. So I have, it's not, this is not official, but I call it Camp Crozier. And you could see they built cairns that could be seen from the north, so that people coming after you, and I bet one part of the system would have been sort of scouts to go ahead to find a place to rest. And it's on the edge of Seal, northern edge of Seal Bay, another bay. Yeah,
right.
I can't say I came away with anything else in material terms,
right?
Apart from that.
Bill, that's quite interesting, and again causes us to return to the larger question of of what happened, where did the men go, and there is, of course, and you discuss this in the book, there is a belief from the Inuit oral tradition and an analysis of bones which suggests the possibility of cannibalism. And I know you deal with that pretty straightforwardly in the book, but perhaps for the podcast listeners, you could just quickly touch on.
It's very murky, very, very murky. This is, there was a chap who was a Hudson Bay employee, Dr. John Ray.
Right. Yes.
Who seems to have had a pathological hatred of the Navy. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
And I can pinpoint it. During the Franklin searches, 2 naval officers were sent south to get a message to the Admiralty that where the different ships were. And they turned up at Ray's fort, where he was in charge of this sort of little district.
Right.
And he was a bit put out for a start. Where did you come from? You're not actually invited here. But it got worse because they were there for about 2 months. They couldn't move out.
Oh, my.
Called them self-sufficient donkeys. And he wrote this down. Now, one of them was Lieutenant Hoover. He went sort of told to Ray that he was writing a book about his experiences. And he said, I was talking to some of your team, and you've had cannibalism here.
Interesting.
And Ray said, first denied it, and then he said, well, I don't want you to write about it, okay? Nobody else knows. Let's keep it quiet. So he had this experience. When he went north on another to try and find the Northwest Passage for himself and the Hudson Bay Company, he met the Netsilik tribe. Netsilik tribe are notorious. They are driven, they're a very aggressive tribe. They've driven all other tribes back. There's a lot of research done into this. They took over this part of King William Island, exactly the same place that Franklin's, that they were really ones that had difficulty going any further with scurvy and all the rest of it. He knew that the Inuit had a tradition, actually, of cannibalism. And you can understand why. If Granny, she's not helping out, so she might make a nice meal to get us through the next bit.
Yeah.
This is not at all unusual. So I'm convinced that Ray sort of fed them information, and or not information, but of tales of cannibalism. This went in, he reproduced it later as their idea, not his idea. And that was a real insult to those men. Mm. And then lately, bones were looked at, these cut marks on them. And they all said, oh, yes, obviously, this is quite clearly cannibalism. In fact, it wasn't. They're all signs. I've gone to saw York to look at bones there from battlefields and whatever. And just the same, exactly the same. And they've got most of the cuts are on the hands, on the remains of the hands. That's them defending themselves. The idea that cannibalism should be bowled out straight away. The only way it could work is if they were attacked by the native, by the Netsalik, because the Netsalik thought all their birthdays had come at once. It was all these resources, you know, metal, wooden, large wooden boats, all sorts of things that they just couldn't get their hands on anywhere else. It was an easy target. Then the next thing they came out with and said was, well, clearly wrong. The Netsalik tribe are actually a Stone Age people. All their tools are made of slate and, you know, stones mounted as weapons or whatever, which is nonsense because Ross, again, John Ross, abandoned two ships in the Netsalik area. One with the Victory and the Krusenstern. And you can still there go there today and see great big cogwheels made of metal. The Netsalik had absolute access to metal they'd never had before. And there's no doubt about it that these poor men were hacked down and killed.
There was also a suggestion that, because there was a lot of damage to finger bones found, that they would have been cut off to frostbite. For example, Ranulph Fiennes cut the end of his fingers off.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
But there was a suggestion that because there were a lot of finger bones found, that it had actually been the ship surgeons removing frostbitten limbs.
Yeah, but other bones are on the long limbs.
Mm.
Now, I have suggested, and everyone agrees from these who's been up there and talked to the native people, was that if you attack someone and kill them, you had to mutilate the body. There's no question of that, because the body or spirit would get up and then pursue you.
Yeah.
That was a firm belief. And so I mentioned in the book that they would have just hacked into the bodies, broken the long bones, broken the arm bones, all the rest of it. That's all that damage was. Nothing to do with cannibalism.
Yeah.
Oh, and don't forget, of course, the other thing is there was 40 pounds of chocolate in one of the boats when it was found 10 years later.
40 pounds of chocolate? That's a lot of chocolate. Well, you know, it keeps, of course, and so on. So just for us to round this off, what is your next project? I mean, we've focused obviously on this book because it's your new one, and we want to make sure that you know, people track it down and read it. But any more visits to the Arctic, or are you headed in a different direction with your?
No, I'm 80 next month, and the idea that get back up and try and do that again, I think, is remote. I like puzzles, and the first one is why do we have an RAF? What are they needed for? You know, this day and age, and it was really a bad mistake taking the aeroplanes from the army, taking the aeroplanes from the navy, and creating. And here's the word, independent force. That's the first title they were given.
Mm.
So that's one project. Another project is I've discovered who Jack the Ripper is.
Oh, boy. There's
now I can't tell you anything.
Don't tell us now. Don't tell us.
But yeah.
I've got about, 30,000 words down at the moment.
Right.
And an extraordinary story. He was a very famous man of his time.
All right. We should probably leave it at that, because otherwise, you know, if you're going to write this book, if you tell us now.
You've got to present the case in its whole.
Yes, absolutely. That sounds like an intriguing potential read, which I will certainly, and I'm sure Chris too, will be quite interested to see how that one goes. But for now, Chris, do you want to remind our listeners about the book and where they can find it and so on?
It is called No Earthly Pole. It's by Ernest Coleman, and you can get it from all good bookshops, including the online one that goes towards sending someone to space. But we're also going to whack it onto the History Hack bookshop as well, so that Ernest gets a bit more of the money, we get a little bit of money, and we're not going to waste it on rocket fuel.
Money means the kids can eat now.
There you go. Yeah.
Or I might try and convince Alex to put the money towards us going to the Cocos Islands to look at the wreck of the Emden, and so I can write about that. It's a lot warmer in the Cocos Islands than it is in the Arctic.
I thoroughly enjoy this. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Amy.
For coming on History Hack today and telling us about your own travels and your work in terms of unpicking the puzzle of the Franklin expedition and what happened in the end.
Thank you very much indeed again for inviting me.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.